Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Laura Newland, author of Chasing the Zeros, about what the lure of a Wall Street career is doing to students at elite colleges. And later, we'll hear from Tom Philpott, food and agriculture correspondent from Mother Jones, on the matter of genetic modification and other ag tech. Between the two, some excerpts from Seattle Socialist City Council members Kishama Sawant's response to the State of the Union address. First up, Laura Newland, author of Chasing Zeros, The Rise of Student Debt, The Fall of the College Ideal, and One Overachiever's Misguided Pursuit of Success, just out from Stonehall Press. It's a story of what life is like at elite colleges these days, in her case, Duke, the career anxieties, the debt, or the lure of a Wall Street career. It's yet another tale of a society increasingly poisoned by money. Laura Newland. I was really quite stunned by the description of your arrival at Duke. I got to Yale in the early 70s and was overwhelmed by the surroundings, but it was nothing quite like what you experienced. Could you give the feel for what it was like when you first arrived in Durham?
Sure. So I grew up in a college town in Alabama and went to Duke and had never even heard of the bank Goldman Sachs. I had no understanding of what investment banking was and certainly no desire to go into finance. And I arrived at Duke expecting what I thought would be a typical liberal arts education. I went in not knowing what I wanted to study or what I wanted to do, and I thought that was okay. I thought I would have time to figure it out. Instead, what I discovered when I got on campus is that my peers were hyper-competitive, very pre-professional, and that Wall Street had an incredibly strong presence on campus, and that they were the clear front runners in this recruiting game that started for underclassmen. And I immediately felt this pressure to begin thinking about careers. And as I did that, I realized that Wall Street was the most accessible option, and in many ways, the default option.
Even from the first moment in a classroom, it's just brutally competitive, right? That economics professor was quite a character.
Yes, I did have quite an interesting first class experience, I think, what you mentioned. I had an economics professor who was very intimidating. She said in the opening minutes of class that this would be a very difficult course and we should not expect her to create any sort of curve. Many of us will not even pass the class. And it was just this eye-opening experience of what have I gotten myself into here.
Yeah, my first economics class in college was with James Tobin, the Nobel Prize winner who had advised President Kennedy. And believe me, it was nothing like that. So the transformation over the 35 or so intervening years is just remarkable. But this was not an isolated instance. Was this the general atmosphere on the campus?
I would say that one professor was more of an isolated incident. It just because it was the very first class I walked into on campus, it made such an impression. And I think it was reflective in some ways of the experience I had at Duke in terms of the competitiveness. But I would have to say very honestly that I had a number of incredible professors at Duke and a lot of classes that I truly enjoyed.
Were you prepared at all for this? You grew up in a college town in Alabama, but was there any sense of your mind that there were so many sharks swimming around in the tank?
I was not prepared for it. And the thing is, I thought I was prepared for college life. I, like so many high school students, did a lot of research. I read the guidebooks. I went on campus tours, visiting these colleges. And I thought I had learned everything I could in deciding which college to go to and then preparing for that school. But what I didn't realize in that, in all the statistics and all the anecdotes that are shared about these schools by admissions officers or by these guidebooks, there's one statistic that is never mentioned and one that I think should be mentioned because it's so important. And that is, what is a graduate of this college most likely to do upon graduation? Where are they most likely to end up? I think that's incredibly important. Another important statistic is, what industries are most represented at the career fair? What recruiters are most prevalent on campus? And if I had seen those statistics, I would have known that at Duke, at Harvard, at Columbia, at all of these top schools, I would have known that a graduate was more likely to leave as a banker than anything else. And I would have known that the majority of the recruiters on campus were Wall Street banks. So I would have been more prepared. But that side of the story was never told.
Yeah, when I was in college, I think I knew one guy who wanted to become an investment banker, and we all thought that was kind of mysterious. Pre-med, pre-law, that was common, but those are now taking a backseat to pre-Wall Street.
Yes, absolutely. I think it is a shame that our best and brightest students are more likely to become bankers than engineers, teachers, doctors.
So how did you get the idea of at least contemplating a career on Wall Street?
It was never a conscious decision. It was something that crept up on me. I became aware of Wall Street's presence during my freshman year. It was clear that those jobs were the most glamorous, the most sought after. I did have student debt, which certainly affected my decision-making about where I would go upon graduation. So I think for a lot of students, there's never this moment of, I want to be a banker more than anything else. I think that you see so many of your peers pursuing these jobs, and so you begin to look into it too. And the more I looked into it, the more I was seduced by the glamour and the prestige and the money that banking offered.
Yeah, I wonder about the mix of these things. I mean, there's a book by a guy who spent a brief career as a derivative salesman, came out about 15 years ago, Fiasco by Frank Partnoy. He recalls asking his colleagues, if you had a choice between doing this and being a railroad yard clerk for the same pay, which would you rather do? And they all said they'd rather be a yard clerk. Is it the work, or is it the money, or what precisely is the lure? I know you're not supposed to say in the interview that it's the money, but what really enters the calculations?
The money is a huge part of it. Entry-level bankers can earn $70,000 base salary, and that doesn't even include the bonus, which can easily take your income to six figures. And as a 22 or 23-year-old, that's a lot of money. That's very hard to turn down. So you cannot discount the importance of money, especially in an age where the average college student graduates with over $25,000 of student debt. And as these graduates consider postgraduate education, the debt is only going to increase. Today's medical student graduates with over $150,000 of student debt. So money plays a very important role in this decision-making. And the other important piece of this is just the effectiveness of Wall Street's recruiting campaign. They are the most present on campus. They begin targeting you as a freshman or a sophomore. They host a number of events on campus. They seem to be there all the time, everywhere. At their events, they serve the best food. They have the snazziest giveaways. They bring in the most employees to talk to you and woo you. And then they'll fly you to Manhattan for a night on the town and an interview at their offices. And all of those things are fun and they're glamorous. And you kind of realize that this is a lifestyle that would be fun to live out in my 20s.
Just behind the Wall Street banks or, of course, the prestige consulting firms, right?
Yeah, so the consulting firms do have similar recruiting tactics as Wall Street's banks. They don't begin targeting students nearly as early on, and it's a slightly toned-down version, but there are a lot of similarities. The one thing that's important to note is that the consulting industry never had to be bailed out by the taxpayers. They never were responsible for bringing down the economy. I think it's easy to lump the two together, but there are a lot of differences in how those industries conduct themselves.
So the process for interviewing, preparing for interviewing, gets started pretty early. When did you get started thinking about your first interviews?
Yeah, so I started during my sophomore year, and that's because I knew that it was very important to have a summer internship and to have that sort of experience on my resume. The problem today is that the vast majority of summer internships, especially for underclassmen, are unpaid. So what that means is that there's a serious advantage to students whose parents are willing to fund a summer in New York or in D.C. where most of those internship opportunities exist. I did not come from such a family that was willing to foot that bill for the summer. So I started to look into internships that were paid. And Wall Street is one of the only industries that offers paid internships for underclassmen. So I thought, hey, I need an internship. I need something on my resume. I have to get paid for it. So I started applying to Wall Street internships at that time.
And the pay is not merely symbolic, right? Some of it can get pretty substantial.
Oh, yeah. You can make a lot of money as an intern on Wall Street. You get paid a prorated amount of that $70,000 entry-level salary that I mentioned earlier. And you can also make time and a half for overtime pay at some, but not all, banks. And then if you're a junior and a summer intern, and you accept a full-time offer at the end of the summer, you can frequently get a $10,000 signing bonus at the summer's end. So you could easily return to campus with more than $20,000 in your pocket just from your 10 weeks.
Wow. And for somebody facing $25,000 in debt upon graduation, that's a very tempting lure.
It is.
I'm speaking with Laura Newland, who is the author of Chasing Zeros, The Rise of Student Debt, The Fall of the College Ideal, and One Overachiever's Misguided Pursuit of Success, published by Stonehall Press. The firms all come to campus for like this one-day recruiting binge, right? They set up shop and you walk around as if in some sort of trade fair?
So it's more than just one day. It's a 1 to 2 month recruiting campaign. It begins with a career fair where all the recruiters come, and then they return very often to host information sessions. They'll host workshops. They'll host panels. They'll host lunches. They come for a number of reasons, just so that they can reach as many students as possible. But for the interviews themselves, they do typically occur one day on campus, and that is just the first round interview. And that, the best way I could describe a Wall Street interview to say it's incredibly unpredictable. You never know exactly what you're going to be asked. You could be asked simply about your experiences and why you want to end up on Wall Street, or you could be given brain teasers, very difficult math problems. You could be flat out ignored by your interviews just so that you are put into a stressful situation so that they can see how you react. Your interviewers could be hostile. That's another common and feared scenario that all students are aware of. And again, they're trying to take you so out of your comfort zone so they see how you react. And in many ways, it just comes across as them making mockery of the people who want to work for them, which is not something I appreciated.
Well, it sounds like a very high-stakes fraternity hazing.
I think it could be compared to that in some ways, yes.
How do you prepare for this sort of thing? It's so unpredictable, so stress-inducing. How do you get ready and how do you prepare?
So I did my best to prepare. There were certain questions I knew I would be asked, and I memorized my answers to those. So I knew I would be asked, why do I want to go into finance? Why do I want to work for that particular bank? And I made up these answers that I knew would sound good. I would talk about wanting to be challenged and having this love of a fast-paced environment and working around intelligent people. And that's the sort of stuff that Wall Street really sells you on. That's their primary recruiting message. In terms of the more challenging or stressful parts of the interview, there were only so many things I could do to prepare. I read a number of guides, and they lay out all of these scenarios that could happen, and I did my best to visualize myself in those scenarios. I began practicing these brain teasers that I knew could be thrown my way. You know, what's the square root of 755? And I began thinking, how would I do that? How would I answer that? Which is kind of a fun exercise, but there's only so much you can do to prepare.
Because you just never know what they're going to throw at you.
Right, exactly. That's the point. They don't want you to be able to prepare for this and have this down to a science. They want to make you uncomfortable and see how you're going to react.
And the reason that the interviewer is on the other side of the desk and the reason that most of the applicants are talking to the interviewer is because they want to make lots of money. And certainly there's some prestige attached and glamour, but it's mostly about the money, but you're not supposed to say that.
Right. That's the rule. That's the unspoken rule. You should never, ever mention that you're attracted to Wall Street because of the high salaries that they offer. Instead, you're supposed to talk about these ideas of being challenged or working around these very bright people. And if you were to ever mention money, I think an interview would probably end right then and there. So it's kind of that appeal that's always right under the surface, but no one dares to mention it. Not in an interview. It never comes up at a career fair or at an information session. That's just not something that is mentioned.
So what kind of interviews did you have?
So I had ones, like what I mentioned, I fortunately never had one where my interviewer was openly hostile, but I did have some very difficult brain teaser, mathematical type questions that really stumped me and made me very uncomfortable. I was given some strange hypothetical questions that tried to evaluate whether I would place work over my personal life. And I definitely say that I would say that the interviews made me uncomfortable in a lot of situations. And sometimes I reacted well to that, and other times I did not.
Now, what about the gendering of this? Wall Street has historically been a very male place and has not been very friendly to women. What's it like for a woman entering this process?
So I think today it's a lot different for a woman than it was 10 or 15 years ago. On a number of occasions, I did have female interviewers. I think the banks make a true effort that when they send recruiters to campus, they try and have a lot of female representation. So I would say that Wall Street is changing in that respect, and they are at least aware of this negative perception of this gender bias in the industry. So I would not say that I ever faced too much of a challenge being a female, because I think that a lot of that is changing, and they are making a true effort to appear more welcoming to women. Now, whether that is true once you actually get into the industry and are working on the trading floor or in the office, I can't really speak to that. But I would say that in their recruiting campaigns, they are clearly trying to show that they are welcome to everybody.
You did not end up on Wall Street, and people will have to get the book to understand, to learn why. But I do want you to reflect upon what do you think this focus on Wall Street at elite universities is doing to education and to our society?
I think that today college has morphed into something that my parents' generation would have a hard time recognizing. As you mentioned before, I think we like to think of colleges as bastions of higher learning, where students explore their interests, discover how to best serve society. But I think all of that is changing because of the rising cost of college and also the competitiveness of my generation. I think Wall Street has played a very big part of that, and universities have as well. So it's not that this is the fault of any single industry or institution, but I think we need to shift the conversation almost away from Wall Street and toward this higher education system. And we need to talk about what they are doing to prepare society's next generation of leaders. I don't think that they are doing everything they can to instill these values that we like to associate with college and with higher education. I think that they are allowing money and finances to play too big of a role in a student's decision-making process.
Well, it's also to the point where fields which are socially very necessary, like medical research or engineering, have become so unattractive salary-wise next to Wall Street that people are just not going into the field, are they?
Right, right. A physician today is not even going to begin earning money until their late 20s or early 30s. And by then they have so much debt accumulated that it's really going to hurt their earning power. By the time you're 30 on Wall Street, you could be making easily six figures a base salary each year.
Did any of your fellow students at Duke have reservations about this competitiveness and the Wall Street dominance, or are they just now so used to it that it seems almost like part of nature?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because a topic of conversation that came up a lot on campus among my peers or written about in the student papers or spoken about by certain professors is, we would always ask ourselves, why are we doing this? And we would, in many ways, bemoan the presence of Wall Street or bemoan the number of our peers who were going into this industry. But when push came to shove, so many of us would do it anyway. And we would maybe make light of it or try to justify it. And we understood deep down that this isn't why we came to college, or maybe this wasn't the best use of our potential. But you still get sucked into it anyway, and you can always find a reason to justify your behavior. And I think that's something that's going on a lot on campuses. So I don't want to create the impression that students are completely blind to some of the consequences of this behavior. We're aware of it, but Wall Street has established such a presence, and they, in many ways, make this offer that's so difficult to refuse that they're coming out ahead anyway.
I believe you suggested that maybe we should contemplate banning Wall Street recruiters from campuses the way they banned ROTC.
Yeah, so I did write a piece in the Huffington Post about that. And my real goal in writing that was just to call attention to what I believe is a hypocritical stance by the Ivy League when it comes to recruitment. They did block ROTC on campuses because of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And the Ivy League, or at least four Ivy League colleges, I should clarify, those four schools presented themselves as these principled objectors who stand for equality. But when it comes to Wall Street recruitment, they openly encouraged the presence of an industry that was considered to have defrauded taxpayers of $700 billion. So I wanted to draw that parallel between the Ivy League taking a stance against one policy or one industry, but not doing it against another that could easily be considered to have even more destructive policies.
Final question. So what are you doing with yourself now that you've spurned the finance career?
So right now I'm working full-time as a consultant. I'm writing part-time and hoping that I can use this book as a platform to do more writing and get into a more creative field.
That was Laura Newland, author of Chasing Zeros, The Rise of Student Debt, The Fall of the College Ideal, and One Overachiever's Misguided Pursuit of Success, just out from Stonehall Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Bye.
That was some of Wasted Days by Cloud Nothings from their 2012 album Attack on Memory. I think it's a good song. Haven't made up my mind yet. Next up is an excerpt from Kashama Sawant's response to Obama's banal and devious State of the Union address. Sawant, who was a guest on this show in October, ran a successful campaign as an open socialist for the Seattle City Council. The major points of her platform were a $15 an hour minimum wage, taxing the rich, and controlling housing costs. And she won. Obviously, one seat on one city council won't change the world, but it seems like a promising strategy. Unlike, say, third-party presidential runs, which are pure fantasy at this point. Maybe someday, with more organization and more political development, but not now. It's the bourgeoisie's office, not ours. I edited this down to about two-thirds of its original length. You can find the full thing on YouTube.
Tonight, President Obama talked about the deepening inequality. But this is really a testament of his own presidency, a presidency which has betrayed the hopes of tens of millions of people who voted for him out of a genuine desire for a fundamental change away from corporate politics and warmongering. Poverty is at record high numbers. 95% of the gains in the increase in productivity since the so-called recovery began have gone to the top 1%. Obama's focus on income inequality is an admission of the failure of his own policies. And this admission has been forced by rallies, demonstrations, and strikes by fast food and low-wage workers demanding a minimum wage of $15. It has been forced by the outrage over the widening gulf between the super rich and those of us who are working to create the wealth of this society. While the criminals of Wall Street are bailed out, courageous whistleblowers like Edward Snowden are hunted down, while the unconstitutional acts he exposed are allowed to continue. Obama is the president that is using smartphone apps, games like Angry Birds, to spy against tens of millions of people in a completely blatant violation of basic constitutional rights. The president claims ending two wars while he continues to intensify a brutal campaign of drone attacks in multiple countries, killing hundreds of innocent civilians, and not to mention the plight of U.S. soldiers returning with permanent medical conditions and declining veterans' benefits. Obama is the president whose broken website is a symbol of the broken hopes of millions who believed his promises for affordable health care. Climate change is a fact, says Obama. Here is another fact. Climate change is getting worse and worse on his watch. The leadership in stopping the disastrous Keystone XL pipeline has come not from him or Congress, but from the thousands of courageous activists organizing and taking direct action to stop it. Obama shouts, "Fix our broken immigration system." He is the president with the record number of deportations. My brothers and sisters, these problems are not new, and they are not an accident. Working people have faced nearly four decades of wage stagnation and rising income inequality. These four decades with four Republican presidents and three Democratic presidents. Four decades that show that neither party is capable of solving these problems and that they fundamentally represent the same interests, the interests of the super wealthy and big corporations. We will make progress only on the basis of a fundamental and systematic change. We need a break from the policies of Wall Street and corporate America. We need a break from capitalism. Both parties bow down before the free market and loyally serve the interests of their corporate masters, with the only difference being in the matter of degree. We need our own political party, independent of big business and independent of the parties that serve big business. Some will say this can't be done, but look at our campaign for Seattle City Council. I ran as an open socialist. I did not take a penny of corporate cash. We raised $140,000 from ordinary working people who were excited about our campaign. I ran on a platform of a $15 an hour minimum wage, taxing corporations and the super wealthy to pay for mass transit and education, and for affordable housing and rent control. With almost 100,000 votes, my election was the first time in decades an independent socialist was elected in a major U.S. city. It is clear that Americans are looking for something different. Let's talk about minimum wage. President Obama said no one working full-time should have to raise a family in poverty. And his solution? To have $10.10 at minimum wage. But let's be honest, $10.10 over the next 3 years, or $20,000 a year for those who are lucky to have a full-time job, is not a ticket out of poverty for working families. Fast food workers, Walmart workers, and others have gone on strike and built powerful protests in cities in every part of the country over the past year for $15 an hour. And this is the only reason that politicians are now talking about raising the minimum wage. Let's make this a year of action, Obama said. In my view, the action we need is by working people and the poor for higher wages and a $15 an hour minimum wage. I urge you to be part of this struggle for $15 an hour. Find out more and sign up at 15now.org. That's 15now.org. Solidarity.
That was about two-thirds of the response to the State of the Union address from Kishama Sawant, Seattle's Socialist City Councilor. Every city should have at least one. And now here's Tom Philpott, food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. He's also a farmer, to give a dispassionate and rational analysis of a topic that causes a lot of anxiety in some circles, much of it unjustified in my view, genetic modification. A lot of the opposition, it seems to me, is based on some mystical ideas of natural purity rather than a rational evaluation of the science. As I say to Tom in the interview, though I don't trust Monsanto, I don't want to dismiss the technology out of hand. I think the reaction is symptomatic of a broader phenomenon, a confusion of the capitalist debasement of science and the pursuit of profit with the virtues of scientific inquiry itself. Tom Philpott. Welcome, Tom. GMOs are rather controversial, but let's talk about the scope of what genetic modification is all about, how it's being used now. What are most GMO crops engineered for?
Right. Well, right now, about upwards of 90% of soybeans and nearly that much of corn are GMO. And that, you're talking about an expanse of farmland. It's about more than half of U.S. farmland is planted in these two crops every year. And so you're talking about a massive amount of land. It's about equal to the size of two Californias. And there are essentially two traits on the market. So what they do is they insert genes into a species genome from a different species, and the goal is to create a trait, to have the crop do something in the field that is novel or different or useful. And so there's essentially two traits in the market. One of them is known as Roundup Ready. It's a proprietary technology of Monsanto. And so it's engineering corn and soy and cotton and a couple of other crops, mostly big commodity crops, to be able to withstand applications of this herbicide Roundup. The other one is BT, and that's it's a naturally occurring bacterial pesticide. They've taken the toxic gene. It's toxic to certain bugs, and they've taken the toxic gene from it and put it into corn and cotton. And so the corn is constantly expressing this pesticide, and so you've got corn plants that are their own pesticide. It sounds a little bit more menacing than it is, because this particular toxin is not toxic to humans. It's mainly toxic to bugs, and in fact, it's a common pesticide in organic agriculture.
So how worried should we be about it? I know there's a high level of anxiety around genetic modification, but let's try to separate the principle of genetic modification from these actual applications to start with. I mean, how worried should we be about Roundup Ready and this BT thing you're talking about?
Well, I think we should be worried about it to the extent that it influences agricultural decisions, it influences our agriculture in general. And my analysis of it is that it came online in the mid-90s and has basically acted as an intensification of industrial agriculture. It has increased the power of these sort of large agrochemical firms. So, you know, basically you've got a situation where you've got this base of farmers that are in the middle, and on the one side they've got input suppliers. They've got the companies that are selling them pesticides and fertilizers, and it's an extremely consolidated market. On the other side, you've got the grain traders who buy their crops, and the big meat packers who, you know, basically transform the corn and soy into meat. And these are also extremely consolidated markets. So you've got farmers sort of operating in between these two poles, and they have very little power. I mean, we can talk about farm policy and what that really does, but farm policy is really manipulated for both of these outside of farming interests. And so what GMOs did essentially when they came on the market is add another layer and another bit of profit to the input side. So now farmers are not just buying seeds, they're buying the sort of technology patent that's in, you know, that's in these crops. And then, you know, the other thing is that there's this thing called, that ecologists call, the pesticide treadmill. And that is a thing that happens in industrial agriculture when you're basically in this endless war with pests, whether they be weeds or insects. And as you apply pesticides and herbicides, these pests adapt. And so you have to bring out new pesticides, new herbicides, and sort of intensify your applications. And these two particular traits that I've talked about have intensified the herbicide, accelerated the pesticide treadmill, especially in the case of this Roundup Ready stuff. So very rapidly in the Midwest and in the South and cotton country, you got weeds developing resistance to Roundup. And the result has been that farmers have applied more. First, they applied more and more Roundup. And as that became a losing battle, they added other older, more toxic herbicides to the mix. And so you've got this, you know, rampaging pesticide treadmill happening right now. And I think that's the main thing that people should worry about.
Yeah, that strikes me as a far more worrisome thing, dumping all these tons and tons of poisons on the earth. That seems far more worrisome than the anxieties that people have about what it will do to the food itself.
Right. So I think it's true that when you genetically modify a crop, you are creating novel proteins that haven't been seen in the world. And I think that we need a regulatory regime that can deal with that, that can deal with that on a crop-by-crop basis. And it's probably true that the crops that are on the market now aren't putting some damaging protein into the food supply. That doesn't mean that it couldn't happen in the future. And it's also very true that the regulatory regime doesn't do a very good job of vetting these crops. It was basically written by the industry in the 80s, under Reagan and then under Bush. It's an incredibly porous regulatory regime. Having said that, there's a lot of hysteria in, you know, foodie circles and lefty circles about how GMO crops are causing cancer or autism, and there just isn't evidence to back that up.
Yeah, the way I usually put it is, I wouldn't want to dismiss genetic modification out of hand. I just don't trust Monsanto with it. What do you think of that?
I think that's right, but I think there's something that I've been learning about as I report this, and that is that the technology ends up being pretty crude, and Monsanto has way overhyped it. Monsanto and its peers, Syngenta, you know, Dow AgroScience, BASF, these companies have way overhyped it. And what it turns out is when they mapped the human genome in 2000, they expected to find a whole bunch more genes than they found in the human genome. And it turns out that the humans have fewer genes than like a grape. And what that's telling us, so we're obviously a much more complex organism than a grape. And what that's telling us is that genes act in way more complex ways to create traits than was previously known. And so the upshot of that is that there's no gene for something like the way that a plant takes up water or the way that it deals with nitrogen, you know, sort of nitrogen in the soil, which is the main plant food. There's no single gene that regulates these things. These are complex processes. And I think what it turns out is that GMO technology does not have the answer to, you know, the big agricultural problems that are facing us. And one problem that we face is that with all this hype around it and, you know, the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, like the Clinton administration, like the Reagan administration, have all been, you know, completely pro-GMO, promoting it in foreign policy, you know, demanding that other countries accept it and practice it, that putting research money into it. I think that one danger that we have is that in emphasizing it, we're going to not solve the very real problems of, you know, how to feed a world in an unstable climate with growing population.
Well, yeah, there's certainly a lot of simpler approaches to that than high tech, aren't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's classical breeding. There's classical breeding with a high tech twist, and that is that you can say focus on the tomato and decode the tomato genome and find the area in the genome where certain traits are produced in certain varieties of tomato, and you can isolate them and then figure out how to cross them into another variety of tomato. This process ends up being a lot cheaper and in some ways faster and certainly more effective than, say, splicing a pig gene into a tomato to get some trait. You know, it turns out that there is a lot of biodiversity in all the crops we eat. All of them were domesticated somewhere, and where they're domesticated, they have wild relatives. They're growing in a variety of growing conditions. You know, the classic example being Mexico and corn. There's this tremendous biodiversity in Mexico. You've got, you know, little hillsides where it's always dry. You've got other ones where it's always wet. You've got other ones where it's always hot. And by using that natural variation and the high tech, it's called the marker assisted breeding, you can get way more interesting traits faster than this GMO business.
I'm speaking with Tom Philpott, who's the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. But this is, as you say, a high-tech version of something that humans have been doing for eons, right?
It is and it's not. What I'm describing just now is a high-tech version of what humans have been doing for eons. It's just using high-tech measuring tools to speed the pace up. GMO technology is different because it's crossing species.
Okay, what about all there were some grandiose utopian claims about how we could invent magic breeds of corn that would solve malnutrition problems. Has anything come of that, or is that just pure hype?
It's mostly pure hype. There is a kind of rice that's being developed amid much fanfare. It's been in development since the 90s, and currently in the Philippines, it looks like it's getting pretty close. But, you know, the thing is that these problems, so this is kind of rice that they've engineered beta carotene in it. They've engineered the precursor to vitamin A. And the idea is that people are going to eat this rice and it's going to overcome vitamin A deficiencies. But, you know, it's just one of those deals where you have to ask the question, why is there vitamin A deficiencies? And it turns out in most cases that it's a collapse of biodiversity in farm fields where, you know, you've got decades of policies where, you know, the IMF and the World Bank tell countries don't worry about agriculture or focus completely on, you know, commodity crops for the global north. Don't worry about feeding yourselves. The market will take care of you. You know, you'll buy cheap U.S. commodity crops to take care of your food needs, and you'll earn foreign exchange by selling tomatoes for Europe in the case of Africa, or, you know, for the United States in the case of South America. And so what you've gotten is this sort of collapse of agriculture in these places directed at the people who live there, making kind of culturally appropriate food for them. And, you know, the result is stuff like vitamin A deficiency, and there's no greens in the diet and things like that. And, you know, that would be probably a much more difficult thing to do, but one that would actually solve the problem. And there's no evidence that farmers are going to embrace golden rice. There's no evidence that consumers, that, you know, people in these places and places like the Philippines are going to say, hey, you know, I want that, you know, that orange colored rice. That's going to solve all my problems. You know, it is true that they appear to have successfully engineered beta carotene into golden rice, but it's a major question as to whether it's going to solve any problem.
So the alternative to the pesticide treadmill, how does one get off the pesticide treadmill in a way that can feed lots of people at a reasonable cost without poisoning the nest?
Well, you know, it's, I think it's sort of redefining technology. The way that we define technology now in agriculture is something that comes from a bag. You open a bag of fertilizer, you open a bag of these high-tech seeds, and you apply it, and there, you know, there's a patent on it, and someone gets a technology fee for it, and that's what we call technology. But there's also appropriate technology, and there are people doing things in the Midwest, in, you know, the land of gigantic farms, that are using sort of knowledge and instead of this sort of from a bag technology. I did a piece in 2013 on a farmer in Ohio. And he's in an industrial ag country in Ohio. He's got 1,000 acres. He sells into the commodity market. But he's doing a couple of things differently. It's this guy, David Brandt. And what he's doing is he's, instead of growing just corn and soy, he's added a third crop to his rotation, which is wheat, which was ubiquitous all throughout the Midwest. You always had corn, some kind of bean, and then a third grain crop, what they call small grains. It could be oats or wheat. And just by adding that third rotation, he's breaking disease patterns. He's breaking insect patterns. He's adding to the diversity of his feed. He's not just producing two crops, but he's doing three, a more diverse food supply. But he's also doing this thing called cover cropping, where when the season's over, he plants cover crops. And these are a variety of cover crops that just keep his field covered all winter. And then when the summer comes, he doesn't harvest them. When the spring comes, he doesn't harvest them, but he rolls over them with a plow, with a rolling implement, and kills them and creates this mat of dead organic matter on his soil. And then he plants into it his cash crop, his corn, soy, and wheat. And by doing that, he's completely eliminated weeds as a problem. And he's also, the cover crops and their roots, as they die, they feed the soil. Some of them are legumes, which fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and put it into the soil. And as a result of that, he's building organic matter in the soil and fertility. And he uses something like a tenth of the fertilizer of his neighbors, who are all conventional, and about a tenth of the herbicide. So he's not organic. He's using, you know, synthetic nitrogen and synthetic herbicides occasionally, but he's using them sort of like you would use a medicine. For, you know, when a patient gets sick, you prescribe medicine, but you don't prescribe it all the time. And he is just as productive as his neighbors. And in the drought year of 2012, he got 90% of his usual yield, and his neighbors got half to 0% of their usual yield. There were crop failures because there was no rain. And his soil holds water. When you have healthy carbon-rich soil, it holds water. And stuff like that. I mean, I'm giving this example, but there are numerous studies that on test plots in places like Ohio State University that back this up. And just shifting, you know, creating the incentives for farmers to shift over to stuff like that would be a lot cheaper, and you would have a fraction of the agrochemical use. But of course, no one makes money out of it except for the farmer himself.
Right, that's the big drawback. But if we put, you know, what a fraction of the R&D effort into that sort of thing that we do into the high tech stuff, we'd all be a lot better off.
That's right.
Finally, how scalable is organic agriculture? Could we really, you know, convert our agricultural system to a largely organic one, or is that just not practical in a world this big?
I think that it would be difficult to go to a completely organic system. But the system that I just described on the way to organic, I think, would be extremely possible. I mean, I think that, you know, it ends up being kind of a false argument. You know, either organic or these, you know, gigantic, herbicide sucking farms in the Midwest. There's a middle ground, like this farmer, what this farmer David Brandt is doing, that is extremely scalable and practical. And I am getting to the point where I see it as really the only hope. If we don't shift to something like that, I think we're going to continue destroying our soil, polluting our water with agrochemicals. And, you know, the carbon aspect of this is extremely important. We need agricultural soils, which are a huge part of the globe, to be sucking carbon. And right now, they're a net leech on carbon, and that's disastrous for the climate.
Well, this sounds all very reasonable, so, but in an inspiring way. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Doug.
That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Continuing the country mood, let's go out with this. Some of Lay Lady Lay, performed by the German band Melodia from 1993. Till next week, bye.
Lay, lady, lay.